Brahman, the ultimate reality and its symbolical representation. Like most of the other fundamentally logical problems, there is no systematic resolution in the Upanishads of whether Brahman is being or non-being, although some of the later interpretations of the Upanishads have taken dogmatic positions on this score. By themselves, the Upanishads have never turned this issue into a serious controversy and have sometimes stated the ultimate reality as being and sometimes as non-being. Consider, for instance, the following cryptic statement. He who knows the Brahman as non-existing becomes himself non-existing. He who knows the Brahman as existing, him others know as existing. The embodied self of this bliss is the same as that of the former understanding. Taittiriya Upanishad. And when further questioned by the pupils, in the beginning this was non-existing, not defined by form and name. From it was born what exists. That made itself its supreme self. Therefore it is called the supreme self-made. That which is supreme self-made is also the essence. Taittiriya Upanishad. While at one place, the Chandogya Upanishad specifically refutes the priority of non-being, the problem everywhere else is tackled somewhat differently and vaguely, such as in the following passage. In the beginning, darkness, tamas, alone was this. It was in the highest, and then stirred by the highest, it became uneven. Thus, it gathered force, rajas. Then this force being stirred, it became uneven. Thus, it came to light, sattva. Then this light being stirred, the essence flowed forth. This is that part, state of supreme self, which is entirely intelligent, reflected in man, as the sun is in different spots of water, knowing the body, marked by conceiving, willing and believing. It is Prajapati, common to all. Because he thus came to be, he is the created being. Having entered all, he is supreme self within and without. Maitrayani Upanishad. Brahman as the absolute reality is purely impersonal and is not to be confused with a personal god. Footnote. Some passages in a few later Upanishads, such as the Shvetashvatara among the 13 covered here, have been used by some interpreters in later times to cast Brahman in the image of a godlike entity which can be worshipped. This dovetailing of customary theologism into the Vedantic philosophy may have given greater legitimacy to certain evolving theological schools and, at the same time, put the means for divine communion at the disposal of a larger number of people. But most followers of the Upanishads do not accept this compromise as truly representative of Vedantism. In fact, even the Shvetashvatara Upanishad falls in line with the other Upanishads when, at one place, it says, when that light, knowledge of Brahman, has risen, there is no day, no night, neither existence nor non-existence. The fundamental attitude of the Upanishad in regard to this subject is even more sharply revealed in the following passage. Now answer us a further question, ask the pupils of the teacher. Fire, air, sun, time, breath of life, food, Brahma, Rudra, Vishnu, some meditate on one, some on another. Say which of these is the best for us? He said to them, these are but the exalted manifestations of the highest, the immortal, the incorporeal Brahman. He who is devoted to any one of them rejoices here in this world only his presence. Thus he said, Brahman indeed is all this. And a man may meditate on or worship or discard even those which are its primary forms. With these deities, he proceeds to higher and higher worlds. And when all forms perish, he becomes one with the person. Yes, with the person. Maitrayani Upanishad. End of footnote. The significance of Brahman is metaphysical, not theological. Brahman is the featureless absolute, which, unless a contextual necessity otherwise demands, is most appropriately referred to as it. As a matter of fact, the Shvetashvatara Upanishad actually states that no term truly applies, not masculine, not feminine, not even neuter, only whatever body it takes, with that it is joined. Brahman of the Upanishads is also not to be seen as the creator god, as in Judeo-Christian tradition. There is no creation as such in Vedanta. The universe is evolved out of Brahman, as the passage quoted immediately above elucidates quite clearly, or likewise the following. The Brahman expands, manifests itself by means of concentration. Hence is produced matter, food. From matter, life, mind, the intellect, and the seven worlds. And from the works performed in the worlds, follow the endless chain of effects of the works. Mundaka Upanishad. Thus, Brahman is the one and only cause of the coming into existence of the universe. Brahman is whole and unfolds itself out in the form of the universe, out of its own substance, and as a means of knowing itself. Does this self-expression bring about any change in the nature of Brahman? The Brahman remains constant, untouched, unsullied, undiminished. An invocation that precedes all those Upanishads, that is, Brihadaranyaka, Isha, etc., which are dedicated to the white Yajurveda, reads as follows. That is whole. This is whole. This whole proceeds from that whole. On taking away this whole from that whole, it remains whole. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Thus there is nothing, not even the minutest part of the material world, that is not wholly Brahman. Within and without, it is all Brahman. But who can know it so? It is only the individual self, Atman, not anything or anybody else in this phenomenal world, that is so imbued with the potentiality of attaining this knowledge through the realization of its identity with Brahman. The realization of this identity is, therefore, the ultimate fulfillment of individual existence. But what is Brahman? Since it can never be truly designated, the authors of the Upanishads remain non-committal. The pupil asked the teacher, sent forth by whom? Impelled by whom does the mind proceed on its errand? At whose command does the breath go forth? At whose wish do we utter this speech? What power directs the eye or the ear? The teacher replied, it is the ear of the ear, the mind of the mind, the speech of the speech, the breath of the breath, and the eye of the eye. The eye does not go thither, nor speech, nor mind. We do not know it. We do not understand it. How can anyone teach it? It is other than the known. It is also above the unknown. Kena Upanishad. And in case he has not succeeded in convincing his pupil, the teacher adds, if thou thinkest I know it well, then thou knowest surely little. Kena Upanishad. Often in answering questions as to the nature of Brahman, recourse is finally taken to a negative method. Neti, neti, not this, not this, to notify its indefinability. Thus, Yajnavalkya, before retiring to the forests for meditation, imparts to his wife Maitreyi the knowledge of Brahman at her own request. He commences, "As a lump of salt has neither inside nor outside, but is altogether a mass of taste, thus indeed has that supreme self neither inside nor outside, but is altogether a mass of consciousness. And all contingent things, having risen from the elements, vanish again in them. When one departs, there is no more consciousness. This is what I say, O Maitreyi." Thus spoke Yajnavalkya. Then Maitreyi said, "Here, sir, thou hast landed me in utter bewilderment. Indeed, I do not understand this supreme self." But he replied, "O Maitreyi, I say nothing that is bewildering. For only when there is, as it were, any duality, then one sees the other, one smells the other, one tastes the other, one salutes the other, one hears the other, one perceives the other, one touches the other, one knows the other. But when this supreme self is all this, what should see whom? What should hear whom? What should touch whom? What should know whom? With what should one understand him? By whom, indeed, one understands everything. That supreme self is only to be described as not this, not this. He is incomprehensible. How, O beloved, should he know the knower?" Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Sometimes, the teacher, in a frank admission of uncertainty, would conclude his discourse by stating both "may be" and "may not be" terms. In the Chandogya Upanishad, a teacher tells his pupil, "Where one sees nothing else, hears nothing else, understands nothing else, that is the infinite." Whereupon the pupil asks, "Sir, in what does the infinite rest?" The teacher says, "In its own glory, or not even in glory." The teachers of Upanishads are said even to have chosen silence as a means of expounding the nature of Brahman to their pupils. Shankaracharya, the great 8th century expositor of Vedanta and interpreter of the Upanishads, refers to an Upanishad text no longer available in any of the extant Upanishads, where a pupil approaches a teacher to teach him about Brahman. Whereupon the teacher, agreeing to do so, becomes silent. When requested again and again, he said, "I am teaching, but you do not understand. Brahman is silence." Notwithstanding this, and perhaps because of it, the Upanishadic discourse is very rich in the use of analogies and symbols for conveying various ideas about Brahman. The most important symbols are the syllable Om, Prana, the vital breath, Akash, space, Manas, mind, Aditya, the sun, and Vayu, wind or air. Om is the most significant of all the symbols. The syllable Om is formed of three distinct letters, A, U, and M. These three letters cover three states of our experiences. The letter A is basic to all the others. It represents the phenomenal world of our wakeful state, subsuming all our sense perceptions and our mental, intellectual, and reflective activities and their outcomes. The letter U, derived as it is from A, constitutes the world of our dreams in our dreamful state of sleep. While our dream experiences are fundamentally related to those in the wakeful state, they far outstretch it by being able to compress both time and space. The letter M represents the world of dreamless, deep sleep, which is at once cut off from both the previous states. Our experiences in this state are not bounded by space and time. They collapse into one undifferentiated point of consciousness, restful and blissful. Thus, while experiences in both A and U states are different for different beings, the undifferentiated and unbounded consciousness experienced in the deep sleep state is the same for everyone. But there is the fourth state, beyond even the third. It is beyond all the elements and all the letters. There is no commerce with it. It brings all distinctions and developments to end. As such, it is utterly unavailing. It is only peace, repose, and oneness. Mandukya Upanishad. The experiencer of the fourth state is neither outward nor inward directed. He is not directed at all. So he cognizes not, and is himself non-cognizable. He is without signs, without indications, unthinkable and indescribable. His only proof is his presence, peaceful, benign, pure oneness. Mandukya Upanishad. This is the state that brings to summation all the others. All that is there at present, all there was in the past, all there will be in the future, and whatever else beyond all these three. Such, then says the Mandukya Upanishad, is Om, the very self indeed. He who knows this merges his self into the Supreme Self. Yes, he who knows this. Owing to the close association of breath and air, prana and vayu are related and yet distinct. Prana itself is used in a variety of ways, breath, the vital breath, and also as the very life principle which animates even the minutest part of a being. While prana, as the vital principle, is the subtlest form of energy that pervades the cosmos as well as the individual being, vayu, air, is the cosmic breath. So that breath of the individual is but a part manifestation of the cosmic breath. Owing to this parallelism between breath and life, prana and vayu are sometimes identified with each other. Vayu is the link between this and the next life, and the whole cosmos coheres into it. Prana is the source of all the senses, into which they all return at the time of deep sleep. And likewise, at the cosmic level, it is the source of all the divinities and deities, that is, the natural powers which, like the senses, keep the cosmos functioning, into which they all return at the end of a cosmic cycle or kalpa, signifying the vital principle that pervades and sustains the universe and the individual being alike. Prana is thus used as a symbol of Brahman. Prana is verily Brahman. Akash is often inappropriately translated as sky, ether, or even heaven. Like so many Sanskrit terms, Akash too has no real English equivalent. The word closest to it is space, both as the indefinable infinite space and as the intangible, minutest form of substance which imparts to all the tangible objects their manifest form. Although it is said to have been the first of the primal elements to be evolved from Brahman, owing to its priority and formless pervasiveness, Akash is often likened to Brahman. It is from Akash that objects and all beings take their rise, and into it they all return. Thus it is said that Akash is prior to all and is their ultimate end. In the interiority and formlessness of mind, Manas, the authors of the Upanishads found an appropriate enough symbol for Brahman. Mind is the cause of deliberation. It no doubt causes bondage to the worldly objects, but also, when awakened by meditation, it becomes the means of realizing Brahman. So the Upanishads say, meditate on mind as Brahman. The sun, Aditya, is often used as a metaphor, even a symbol for Brahman. It is the center of our planetary space. Its life-inducing rays dispel darkness and fill men's world with drive and energy. Its rise is like spiritual awakening, and its light is like spiritual light. In a manner of speech, therefore, Brahman is the sun of the universe, and the natural sun is only a phenomenal form of Brahman. The Upanishads also abound in analogies and metaphors. Uddalaka, for instance, is explaining Brahman to his son Shvetaketu, saying, the rivers, my son, run, the eastern like the Ganga, toward the east, the western like the Sindhu, toward the west. They go from sea to sea, that is, the clouds lift up the water from sea to the sky and send it back as rain to the sea. They become indeed the sea, and those rivers, when they are in the sea, do not know, I am this or that river. In the same manner, my son, all these creatures, when they have come back from the true, know not that they have come back from the true. Whatever these creatures are here, whether a lion or a wolf or a boar or a worm or a midge or a gnat or a mosquito, that they have become again and again. That which is the subtle essence, in it is the self of all that exists. It is the true. It is the supreme self, and thou, O Shvetaketu, art it. Chandogya Upanishad. Or consider the parable of the two birds. Two birds of the same kind, and inseparable as friends, cling to the same tree. One of them eats the sweet fruit. The other looks on without eating. On the same tree sits a man, immersed in sorrows and grieving for his own impotence. But when he sees the other lord, contented and realizes his glory, then his grief melts away. When the seer sees the brilliant maker and master of the world as the person who has his source in Brahman, then he is wise. And shaking off good and bad, he reaches the highest oneness, free from passions. For he is the breath shining forth in all beings. He who understands this becomes truly wise. Not like the other bird, a babbler anymore. Mundaka Upanishad. In the following verses from the Katha Upanishad, an idea about Brahman is conveyed by distinguishing various familiar objects related to chariot. Know the Supreme Self as one sitting in the chariot, the body as the chariot, the intellect as the charioteer, and the mind as the reins. The senses, they say, are the horses, the objects of the senses, their path. When he, the highest, the supreme self, is in union with the body, the senses, and the mind, then the wise people call him the enjoyer. Katha Upanishad. However, proceeding through the Upanishad, it is soon discovered that the use of similes and symbols is only resorted to as initial or interim instructional devices, which the teachers employ in order to set the minds of the pupils in tune with the subject matter of their pursuit, often to guide them to the path which could, if they of their own volition and effort persisted with it, lead them to the knowledge of Brahman. As the instruction advances and the pupils gather greater insight, these practical aids are altogether dropped, and the pupils are induced to look far beyond these aids to the point where any form of speech or expression utterly fails. The point from whence all speech, with the mind, turns away, unable to reach it, as says the Taittiriya Upanishad.